S-Y-S-D-S-S-I-R-S. Shit got me stressed. Rap about shit I can't feel. How they hold guns when they never seen steel. I really did put weight up on the scale.
For real.
That's why they feel my words like braille. Hope you go to hell for spitting that fake shit. Blaze piff till my eyes get low as the basement. Take trips overseas for G's from Kennedy. Need my remedy. Weed and Hennessy. Blackberry businessman. Don't get banned. Cause I know people and I got friends. And I know goons that'll roll up in the van and kidnap your mans right in front of your fam. I be chilling with fans everywhere that I'm at. Catch me giving them that. Signing they shirt and hat. But whether it's political shit. Shit or just rap, I give them words they can feel, nigga, hold that. Some words you can feel. I represent street. Speaking through real experience every time. That's how we get down, baby. Give you that real shit. Soul Force on the track.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 18 days into the month of November, and you are tuned into long-term memory radio, a presentation of CKUT's community news department. Tonight on the show, Angela Davis is an American political activist and university professor who was associated with the Black Panther Party for self-defense and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Angela Davis is an American. Today, Davis continues to work for radical and gender equality, gay rights, and prison abolition, and is a popular public speaker nationally and internationally. On October 1st, she delivered a speech entitled Media, Race, and Power, the Case of Oscar Grant.
You're listening to a special edition of CKUT's community news program Off the Hour, hosted and engineered by the Avalanche, an initiative of the West Montreal Readaptation Center. All abilities are welcome. If you would like to support the Avalanche on CKUT, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788. We'll be back with long-term memory radio after these messages. Stay tuned. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
Participate in the series on race, media, and power. So this evening, of course, my remarks are framed in relation to the case of Oscar Grant, who, as you all know, was killed by transit police in my home city of Oakland, California, on January 1st of this year. As a matter of fact, I live not very far away from the Bay Area Rapid Transit Station where Oscar Grant was killed. So I have a number of reasons for choosing this particular case. But in relation to the overall theme of the series, I was interested in the proliferation of images that circulated in the hours and weeks after Grant's murder, and the way in which they highlighted the ubiquity of surveillance and the relationship between the media and surveillance. This case also highlights the uses to which multiple actors, the onlookers to the violence, political organizers, representatives on both sides of the criminal legal system, how they attempted to deploy emerging forms of new media. And of course, what has been so unique about this case has been the extent to which the actual killing was recorded by bystanders. We already have the example early on of Rodney King, where it was one video camera then. What, of course, is not unique about this case is that this is just one of the most recent examples of racialized police violence, like the Freddie Villanueva case here in Montreal. So I want to talk about both the uniqueness and the fact that this case recapitulates a long history of racialized violence. The case compels us to reflect on the long history of racial profiling by the police and the dominant media's complicity in this profiling, which stretches back to the period of slavery and persists into the 21st century. But to speak for a moment about the notoriety the case received as a result of the fact that so many onlookers recorded the scene of the shooting, the Washington Post, for example, pointed out that soon after the killing took place, the Oscar Grant shooting became the top ranked story on YouTube's news page. And let's remember that this happened on January 1st. It happened not very long after the election of an African-American to the office of president in the US, at a time when there were many declarations being made about the new post-racial society. And I thought it was very interesting that Barack Obama and his family chose Grant Park in Chicago to deliver the victory speech in the aftermath of the election. And that a young man bearing the name of the site he chose to declare a victory not very long afterwards was shot down by the police. Before actually returning to this case, I wanted to provide for you some personal background and political background. I wanted to talk a bit about my own interest in exploring this topic. I've been an activist in many campaigns against racism, and now I can say that for virtually all of my life, I've been involved in some way or another in these movements and issues and campaigns. And I guess now that I think back, I've also been aware, if not always in nuanced ways, but I've been aware of the role that the media have played in shaping ideologies of race. And for example, as a child, growing up in one of the most segregated cities in the US, if not the most segregated city, Birmingham, Alabama, like everyone else, I was so attuned to the absence of black televisual representation that the very appearance of a black person on the screen was caused to pause and stare at the television. As a matter of fact, in my family, and our routine was no different from that of other black families, if anyone happened to be watching television and a black person appeared, it did not matter in what context, the person would yell throughout the house and everyone would converge, and regardless of whatever else they were doing, and watch this black person. This was always an exceptional moment to relish. But of course, there was a major exception to what you might call this mediated invisibility of people from black communities. And that was the hyper-visibility of black criminality. Everyone learned how to read certain images as imbued with racialized criminality, regardless of whether any text accompanied those images. Most photographs of black people in the white press were mugshots. And we also learned how to be embarrassed whenever we saw such images. After all, it seems that we must have implicitly understood the attribution of criminality performed by those images. We must have understood that it was not only directed towards a particular individual whose mugshot it was, but toward all of us. I guess what I'm talking about is a process of racial profiling. And unfortunately, the legitimization of this racial profiling, even in communities that have been and are targeted by racial profiling. Of course, if we look at the history of photography, the history of photography is very much linked to the police. And the use of the photograph as evidence, and we still often operate under the assumption that a photographic or video image serves as evidence in and of itself. It cannot be contested. But of course, if we think about the Rodney King case, and we know that that case was, that incident that involved multiple police officers beating a black man, Rodney King, we know that the prosecutor, or rather the defense attorneys, were able to get acquittals for all of the police officers by dissecting the video frame by frame and by leading the jury to believe that although Rodney King was the target of many assaults, that he was the one who was the aggressor. But in any event, it's already in 1850, daguerreotypes that were made for the use of Louis Agassiz, who was, of course, the Harvard professor and a naturalist, and he had daguerreotypes done of many different people, and among these were African slaves. But already then, they have the appearance of mugshots. The front view, the profile view, and this is, of course, before the development of police photographic technology. While Agassiz attempted to use these photographs in his process of racial evaluation, we can already see a criminalization process that is linked to this racialization. And that is what I want to talk about this evening. The point I'm making is that that photographic and video images have been heavily mobilized to suit the ideological purposes of racism, and of course to aid the police. Now, in the US, and here in Canada as well, race has always played a central role in constructing presumptions of criminality. And because I think that what we're talking about today are the ways in which the sentiments of slavery still very much influence our lives and our institutions and our psyches. But in the aftermath of the abolition of slavery, former slave states passed new legislation that revised the old slave codes, the old laws governing slaves, in order to regulate the behavior of free black people in ways that were similar to those regulations that had existed during slavery. So instead of slave codes, we now had black codes. And these new black codes proscribe a whole range of actions, such as vagrancy, absence from work, breach of job contracts, the possession of firearms, and insulting gestures or acts. These were acts that were criminalized only when the person charged was black. And of course, many of these acts retain this historical memory of slavery and racism. With the passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, slavery and involuntary servitude were putatively abolished. But even in the Constitution, there is a significant exception to this. In the wording of the 13th Amendment, slavery and involuntary servitude were abolished, quote, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. And according to the black codes, there were crimes defined by state law for which only black people could be duly convicted. Therefore, former slaves who had been recently extricated from a condition of hard labor for life could legally be sentenced to penal servitude. In the immediate aftermath of slavery, the southern states hastened to develop a criminal justice system that could legally restrict the possibilities of freedom for newly released slaves. And so black people became the prime targets of a developing convict lease system, referred to by many as the reincarnation of slavery. I was actually thinking about this musical called Passing Strange. And there's this wonderful scene in which this white woman activist, Dutch woman, anarchist, says, "I want to be reincarcerated as a black man." So, in any event, the Mississippi Black Codes declared as vagrant anyone who was, quote, guilty of theft, had run away from a job, apparently, was drunk, was wanton in conduct or speech, had neglected job or family, had handled money carelessly, and all other idle and disorderly persons. So the point I'm making is that vagrancy was coded as a black crime, punishable by incarceration and forced labor, sometimes on the very plantations that had previously thrived on slave labor. And just a bit more about this history, because I think it's really important. That history inhabits us, and we inhabit that history often without recognizing it. Mary Ellen Curtin did a wonderful study of Alabama prisoners during the decades following emancipation. She points out that before some 400,000 black slaves in Alabama were set free, 99% of all prisoners in Alabama's penitentiaries were white. 99% were white. But as a consequence of the shifts that were provoked by the institution of the slave, of the black codes within a short period of time, the overwhelming majority of Alabama's convicts were black. And this remains the case today. And she observes that, and I'm quoting from her book, although the vast majority of Alabama's antebellum prisoners were white, the popular perception was that the South's true criminals were its black slaves. During the 1870s, the growing number of black prisoners in the South further buttressed the belief that African Americans were inherently criminal and in particular prone to larceny. Now, Frederick Douglass wrote in 1883 about what he called the South's tendency to impute crime to color. I really like that notion of imputing crime to color. When a particularly egregious crime was committed, he noted, not only was guilt frequently assigned to a black person, regardless of the perpetrator's race, but he points out that white men then sometimes sought to escape punishment by disguising themselves as black. So they would commit crimes in blackface. And Douglass describes an incident that took place in Granger County, Tennessee, in which a man who appeared to be black was shot while committing a robbery. The wounded man, however, was discovered to be a reputable white citizen who had colored his face black. Now, the fact that crime continues to be imputed to color resides in the many evocations of racial profiling in our time. That it is possible to be targeted by the police for no other reason than the color of one's skin is not mere speculation. Now, Marianne Curtin, the historian whom I quoted before, has observed that many scholars who have acknowledged the deeply entrenched racism of the post-Civil War structures of punishment in the South have failed to identify the extent to which racism colored common sense understandings of the circumstances surrounding the wholesale criminalization of black communities. Even anti-racist historians, she says, do not go far enough in examining the ways in which black people were made into criminals. They point out, and this, she says, is partially true, that in the aftermath of emancipation, large numbers of black people were forced by their new social conditions to steal in order to survive. It was the transformation of petty thievery into a felony that relegated substantial numbers of black people to the involuntary servitude legalized by the 13th Amendment. And I'm thinking about what Kanye West said in connection with Katrina a number of years ago. He pointed out that many white people who took things from stores and so forth in the aftermath of Katrina were described as forages. black people were looters. And as a matter of fact, I'm remembering this particularly amazing case of a 70-some-year-old black woman who had attempted to bring her disabled husband to a motel in order to escape the flood in a city right outside of New Orleans. And she had brought food from their house, and it was in the truck when she was bringing this food into the motel. She was arrested by the police for looting and ended up spending something like a month behind bars before, as a result of a mass upsurge, the charges will drop. So yeah, we still live with those very real implications of slavery. And so I wanted to go on to point out that this historian, Miriam Elm Curtin, suggests is that it was not only the transformation of such crimes as petty thievery into felonies, which kind of helps us understand, you know, why in the U.S. there are so many black people behind bars today. There are 2.3 million people in U.S. Prisons, and the majority, the overwhelming majority of them are people of color. And many of them are in relationship to drug charges. But she pointed out that these charges were often fabricated, the charges of theft were often fabricated outright. And she said they, quote, also served as subterfuge for political revenge. After emancipation, the courtroom became an ideal place to exact racial retribution. So in this sense, the work of the criminal justice system was intimately related to the extra-legal work of lynching. These historical modes of linking racialization to criminalization, because I think they help us to understand how such a practice as racial profiling by police departments is not an irrational holdover from forms of racism that have otherwise been abolished. The constant monitoring, the constant surveillance of communities of color by law enforcement and penal systems, and oftentimes assisted by the media, continues to reflect the degree to which populations of color are seen as a threat. And so institutional resources that should be made available, I'm talking about jobs and education and recreation and health care, are replaced by repression, by law enforcement and imprisonment. Instead of seriously addressing the problems in our communities, policies and practices of repression are designed to get rid of the people who have the problems in order to be extricated from the responsibility of solving those social problems. So.
You're listening to a special edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour, hosted and engineered by The Avalanche, an initiative of the West Montreal Readaptation Center. All abilities are welcome. If you would like to support The Avalanche on CKUT, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788. We'll be back with more long-term memory radio after these messages. Stay tuned.
For the first time on the stages of Montreal Centaur Theatre, performer and director Marie Brassard presents Jimmy, her evocative solo show about dreams and desire, from November 25th to 29th. The story of a homosexual hairdresser who comes to life in the dream of a homophobic American general, Jimmy is a beautifully haunting tour de force about longing and loneliness. Frozen in a moment of pure pleasure, Jimmy tries to escape the logic of the dreams that imprison him so he can finally find his way back to his lost love. Jimmy runs from November 25th to 29th at the Centaur Theatre, located at 453 Saint-François-Xavier. For tickets, call 514-288-3161. For more information, visit infrarouge.org. Jimmy is a CKUT co-presentation.
I wanted to take the Oscar Pratt story as a media phenomenon and consider what demands have arisen from communities that have felt outraged at this killing. So what do you think would be the most obvious demand? Firing officers. Okay, maybe I should explain. Oscar Grant was a young man, I think he was 22 years old, who had had some run-ins with the police, but he was actually, at the time of his death, he was a member of a I think the grocer's union, and worked as a butcher. So it must have been the butcher's union. And his union actually did a wonderful job of standing up for him. He had been out on New Year's Eve. Who went out on New Year's Eve? I mean, people do all kinds of crazy things on New Year's Eve. But most people drink too much, for one. I mean, that's almost normal, isn't it? Fortunately, if they were drinking, they weren't driving because they were on the BART, which is our, you know, Bay Area Rapid Transit. They were coming home, a group of friends, Oscar Grant and his friends were on their way home from a party. And apparently there was a little scuffle in the train, and the police, the police got the message that there was a fight that had broken out. And, you know, rather than trying to figure out, well, is everyone okay? Is this an issue that really needs to involve an arrest? They chose people who looked a certain way and chose a number of them, including Oscar Grant, to arrest. And the video, the many video recordings that we've seen depict a group of police officers surrounding Grant, who was pushed down to the floor on his chest, on his stomach. And apparently he was being handcuffed when one of the cops, Johannes Messerli, stands up, pulls his gun out, and shoots it. And so, it's interesting that many of the people who took video recordings must have realized that this was something that was escalating. But he had no weapon. He was totally unarmed. The police had tasers and they had guns. And later, of course, there were those who said, well, he was, the officer thought he was drawing his taser gun. But there had been a lot of media coverage over a case that had happened some time ago in which someone who was killed precisely because the cop thought he was drawing the taser gun, but drew his gun. And so they redesigned the taser so that it was much smaller and was yellow. And then what's interesting is that the recordings show him looking, pulling the gun and looking at it. So if he looked at it and it wasn't yellow, he shouldn't have shot it. But something happened, and he shot him and killed him just right there, like that, with other cops surrounding him. And the question I'm raising is, what do you think should be done? Well, there will be a trial. But in terms of community demands, what kind of demand should one make? take college. Oh, that's actually a good idea, you know, because we've talked about dealing with gun violence and getting rid of guns, but I think if we got rid of the guns that the police had, then we could easily get rid of all the other guns. But yeah, I think that's a very good idea. What I'm driving at is a dilemma that many of us experienced here. And I can't tell you how many of these cases I've been involved in. I can't count the number of cases. And I'm getting really, really tired of assuming that all you have to do is prosecute the individual policeman, a policewoman, because women aren't exempt from this. That all you have to do is identify the individuals as happened in Abu Ghraib, right? And then you point them out as bad apples, and the system continues to function as before. As a person who's been doing a lot of work around prison issues for many, many, many years, I consider myself an abolitionist, which is to say that I want to see eventually the abolition of imprisonment as the dominant mode of punishment. Get rid of it. And think about what would really begin to solve all of the problems that cause people to go to prison, whether we're talking about problems of education to deal with illiteracy, whether we're talking about jobs, or whether we're talking about the horrible cases of violence that people often commit. And it's, you know, one of the things I discovered is that the fact that we have this prison system completely shuts off serious thinking about how to solve some of these major problems. Because if you have someone who has committed a horrible act of sexual violence, say, and you think all you have to do is put this person in prison and you've solved the problem, you haven't even begun to understand how it is that a human being could commit such a terrible act against another human being. And in that sense, we allow this violence to replicate because we simply throw the person who's committed the violence into prison, and then we know that in many instances there's a generational dimension there. And so people continue to do it. It's been going on and on and on, and continue. So in a sense, using the prison is a way of guaranteeing the reproduction of those problems. So what about Johannes Messier? If and many of us who are abolitionists talked about this, to say that if we are for abolitionists, can we in good conscience call only for the prosecution and imprisonment of this police officer? Or should our demands be focused somewhere else? I am much more interested in the embedded racism, the systemic racism, the structural racism that encourages individuals to commit such acts. Regardless of why he did this, whether he thought it was a taser or not, you know, what convinced this man that it would be okay to shoot a young black person like that? I mean, I'm certain that if the kids came from one of the white suburbs, they wouldn't have reacted that way. But then on the other hand, I have to think that white kids are often the targets of violence, that police violence, structural violence that has a racialized history as well. As a matter of fact, I recently read that proportionately fewer black people are now arrested and, or now convicted on drug charges. So some people responded, oh, well, that's good that black people aren't doing so many drugs. Black youth aren't Latinos, so you know, stop doing so much, you know, whatever, whether it's meth or. But the thing is that if you look at drug use, it's pretty much the same across racial lines. As a matter of fact, drug use and drug trafficking. So if you assume that white kids do drugs at about the same rate as, proportionally about the same rate as black kids or Latino kids, and then you go into prison to see who's in prison on drug charges, who do you see? So there's really something happening here. And that has to do with surveillance. That has to do, and this is why I think surveillance is really the key to understanding this whole symbiotic relationship between racialization and criminalization. Because if you live in a community that isn't subjected to surveillance, and I think the media often are complicit in that surveillance, a lack of it, considering who gets portrayed in various ways on television and the press, and the movies as the criminals, as the ones who are the drug users and the drug. But the point that I'm making is that the apparatus of surveillance is infected with racism. And so even when it does not claim as many black bodies as it may have previously claimed, the apparatus is still racist. Even though white kids may be subject to greater surveillance, there's still this racist character to the structure of the surveillance. I mean, does that make sense? Does it make sense? Well, the most compelling example I have to offer you, and I like to talk about this, it's actually a you know, about the death penalty. If you try to figure out, you know, why do we still have the death penalty in the U.S.? I mean, can you figure it? Do you know why? The U.S. that claims to be the paragon of democracy, right? The only industrial democracy in the world that routinely uses capital punishment. Can you explain that? I mean, that this was supposed to have been obsolete centuries ago, actually. As a matter of fact, when the prison was introduced as the dominant mode of punishment, it was supposed to replace capital punishment and corporal punishment. That was the whole idea. The penitentiary, the place to be penitent, was supposed to be a humanitarian mode of punishment as opposed to cutting off people's limbs or putting them the racks or executing them. But we still have a situation where people are routinely executed. And in California, vast numbers of people are on death row in Texas. And my explanation is that capital punishment was given a new lease on life precisely because it was used against slaves initially. I mean, there were states in the South where capital punishment became almost completely abolished for white people. When I say almost completely abolished, I mean that it could only be meted out to a white person for murder. But for black people, there were scores and scores of offenses that still were capital offenses. This was in the slave codes. Frederick Douglass pointed out that in Virginia at one point, there were 77 different offenses that were capital for slaves and only one for white people. And so in the aftermath of slavery, that racialization of capital punishment lived on. And I think now, when we talk about the death penalty, it is a racist apparatus. It's not just the fact that it claims black bodies, but regardless of the race of the bodies it claims, it is still racist. So I want us to think about the extent to which the racism resides in the institutional structures. And I realize that I'm over time now. What time is it?
7:45.
It's almost
Can we do for 5 minutes
so
we have some time for questions?
Yes. Okay. Well, we want to save some time for questions, so let me see if I can wind up. Just very quickly, I had some... I was going to talk about Obama. Raise a local media, of course, play an enormous role in this case involving Henry Louis Gates. Henry Louis Gates, the black Harvard professor who returns from a research trip in China to only to discover that his key doesn't work, it got jammed in the lock. And the taxi driver was trying to help him unjam it, and someone called the police, right? Two black men are trying to break into a house. And I think that probably him and Louis Gates was so surprised that he was the target of this kind of police action that he probably just went off. And you know the story, right? Okay. Now, what I'm interested in is the way in which it was putatively resolved. And you know that Gates, Skip, as the president calls him, because they're friends, was invited to come to the White House along with the white cop, and I can't remember his name. So the three of them could have a beer. Now, I mean, first of all, the whole masculinist character of this. Obama did not recognize the implications of what they were doing. You know, it was as if this situation was something to be solved among honorable men. No women involved. And that meeting at the White House marked the closure of public conversation about race, racial profiling, racism and the police. It should have marked an opening. And Mark Raboy was pointing out that if there is to be a public conversation, the media will have to play a major role in it. If you look, there's an enormous amount of coverage of that incident up until the time they sit down with their beer. Afterwards, the coverage focuses on what kind of beer they were drinking, and who got beer that was made in the U.S., and who got beer that wasn't. And then it just totally disintegrated. What What I think we need to acknowledge is that racism, that if racism is simply viewed as an anachronistic vestige of the past, then we fail to grasp the extent to which the long memory of institutions and I think institutions often have a much longer memory than individuals. And especially those institutions that constitute the intimately connected circuit of education and incarceration. The long memory of institutions continues to permit race to determine, for example, who has access to education and who has access to incarceration. While laws the laws that have been passed, we talk about civil rights laws in the US, right? And there are so many. And those laws are good. But they often have the effect of privatizing racist attitudes and eliminating the explicitly racist practice of institutions, the explicit racism of institutions. But these laws are unable to apprehend the deep structural life of racism. And therefore, they allow it to continue to thrive. And this invisible work of racism not only influences the life chances of millions of people, it helps to nourish a psychic reservoir of racism that often erupts. I don't know whether you've heard people say something and then they say, I don't know where that came from. I'm not a racist. But there are many reasons why we should be exploring how strategies we should be exploring strategies of decarceration that have a great deal to do with these understandings of the structures of racism and the structural character of racism. But I'll just say very briefly, I've been speaking all evening as if we could think about racism as something that is that could be isolated. But it's not. It's not isolated from gender issues and sexism. One of the things I've been talking about in the media since I've been here is the fact that transgender issues are some of the most interesting questions that we are now exploring in relation to the prison system. Because trans people are more criminalized than any other group of people, and particularly trans people of color. And then when you think of the role that the prison plays as an apparatus that preserves racism, and that often is functions according to old systems of segregation, racial segregation, but at the same time, it's a great gendering apparatus because they're prisons for men and then they're prisons for women, right? And so, what happens if you fall somewhere else? If you don't assent to that binary notion of gender, and you think a person can be gender non-conforming, or a person can be a trans woman, or a trans man, or a transsexual. So what happens to all of those other categories? The prison shuts them out. And the way that it does, it shuts out conversation and thinking about so many important issues. So you see, this whole question of abolition is not just about getting rid of the prison, it's about allowing us to think in more nuanced ways about our lives. New openings new historical conjuncture. I think this is a new historical conjuncture. I do think we have a new terrain. I am glad that we elected Barack Obama as president. But I'm not happy about a lot of things. I'm not happy about his position on Afghanistan. I'm not happy about his position on immigrants and health care. But at the same time, I could go on. I could do another lecture about the things I'm not happy about. But I want to encourage us to build communities of resistance and use alternative media and dominant media when possible to bring together academics and activists and artists and labor organizers and communities of resistance and of transnational solidarity that reach across boundaries of nation and race and gender and sexuality. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a speech by Angela Davis. The speech was entitled Media, Race, and Power, The Case of Oscar Grant, American political activist and university professor who was associated with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She spoke at McGill University on October 1st.
Don't be so gloomy. Try
CKUT 90.3 FM.
It worked.
Oh, goody.
Thanks.
That does it for this edition of Off the Hour. Thank yous go out to everyone from the Avalanche for hosting and engineering this program. And thank you to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. For more information or copy of anything you've heard, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CKUT.ca. Stay tuned. Life in the Motherhood's on deck and coming up next. Have a great night. We'll see you in seven.
Avalanche out. Kevin, what do you think about the music?
Woo! Feel like I'm in the islands.
It's like really surprised you there.
Eh? Yeah.
Woo! Yeah. Okay. See you guys.